One thing that's really important to do before we start is to give recognition to the original stewards of these territories. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Latrice Tassi.
Okihini stuni darniku, Aniskamaki. Hello, my name is Latrice Tassi. My Blackfeet Omskapi Pekani name is Buffalo Stone Woman. I'm a LRES grad student in my fourth semester, and it's an honor to be here to introduce Chris and the Indigenous peoples working on this research, because it's so important to have Indigenous researchers researching Indigenous cultural sciences so that we can give back to the earth that is so important to us. So this evening is important to recognize that our learning will be taking place in the traditional ancestral territory of the Niscitapi people, our people, the Blackfoot Confederacy, our four sovereign nations that predate the creation of the U.S. and Canadian border. It is also important to welcome our Inuit colleagues, Esau and Robert, our friend CJ, as they share their knowledge and work on the future of Indigenous peoples. The Inuit of the Arctic and the Blackfeet share something in common, and that is our ice and snow. Glacier ice and winter snows from our mountains what is now called Glacier National Park have provided water and safe passage for our people for time immemorial. In a world connected by climate, relations, and technology, we are connected through the future of ice and indigenous people of the Arctic as both Indigenous people and as global citizens too. Thank you for joining tonight. We hope you enjoy the show.
Oki nitaniku matoye kayokstok mioki. Kitsoum tsiksika taipiksi.
My name is Christopher Carter. My given Blackfeet name is Man of the Big Water, and I'd like to acknowledge the original stewards of this land, the Blackfeet. As someone who's not from the Arctic, but with ambitions to become an accomplice, it's important to state before we dive into our talk tonight that I do not speak on the behalf of Arctic people, but rather I'd like to share what we've been up to and to work better in step with these communities and leaders. I'd like to give our thanks to the Museum of the Rockies for the chance to share, as well as the Gallatin Valley Community Radio and Polar Bears International for providing those recordings. Our hope this evening is to add a human dimension to the Arctic. Many of us from the lower latitudes think of this part of the world as a barren wasteland devoid of humans, when in fact it has been a home to thriving populations for thousands of years, namely the Inuit of what we call Alaska and Arctic Canada today. When we look at the current exhibition just outside these halls, we see some beautiful images, but there's something missing: the people. And tonight we'd like to add a dimension and to remind you that left and right of that frame are societies and people, 4 million to be exact, who live in the Arctic. With that, I'd like to pass it on to my colleague Robert, then Esau, who are joining us remotely from the Arctic, who have been working in the field of tribal leadership and Inuit sovereignty for a few years now. Robert, can you hear us?
Sweet. I would just like to thank the traditional stewards of the land for the territorial land acknowledgement. Uvanga Robert, Ananatsiara and Mickey Johansson, Atatatsiara Bob Hansen, Anaga Giselle, Atataga Rick, Ananaga Udlu. And these are my relations. That's my family that I was introducing to you. And I come from Iqaluit. It's in Nunavut, which is in the Canadian Arctic, the Eastern Canadian Arctic, at the bottom of Baffin Island, also known as Khigitaluk, which we'll get to in a bit. And so I just really want to be able to, I'm not sure where to stare at this point, let's have some fun. I think CJ put it really well when he spoke of really centering the human dimension of Inuit.
Avanga Kagagulilak, Lu, Dalek Lu, Aniokaka, Warren Sinek Lu, Bessie Sinek Lu, Frida Sinek Lu, Fred Taktulu, Aptaga, Shelton Kakiak Lu, John Sinek Lu, Rich Tesenko Lu, Akaga, Clara Shelton, Clara Kakiak, Lou, Minnie Sinek Lou, Rachel Sasenko Lou, Kikdami, Inupia Gurunga. My name is Kugagluilak and Dalek. My English name is Esau Sinek. My parents are Warren Sinek, Bessie Sinek, Frida Sinek, and Fred Taktu. I'm adopted, so I got two sets of parents. My grandfathers are Shelton Kakiak, John Sinek, and Rich Sasenko. My grandmothers are Minnie Sinek, Clara Kakiak, and Rachel Sasenko. And yeah, thank you all for having us. You know, it's a very honor to be able to talk to you all. And thank you.
But yeah, so you might be wondering how a guy from Montana gets connected to two awesome Inuks like these guys. And my work in the Arctic began in 2011 as part of the Inufwatanak project under the auspices of Ruth Montgomery Anderson, my mentor, in Greenland, on the west coast of Greenland. And that really emerged into a dedication to indigenous issues as well as really good regional planning. Thanks to some involvement with the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, all of our paths crossed in 2015 at the Paris Agreement. So you can see us, this is about 7 o'clock in the morning, Robert's on the left, Esau's on the right, and we had both been there, or all three of us had been there for a few weeks working on the draft text that became the Paris Agreement. That was a fantastic time to learn directly from young Inuit what was happening in their home communities. And it was great to see, you can see Esau up top with other Arctic countries working together in the youth caucuses. This is the president of the Canadian Inuit, Natan Obed, Sami Parliament, government of Sweden, and Robert holding it down on some presentations, and then just evolved into a really awesome relationship. Robert and I further worked on establishing the Youth Arctic Coalition. So that's how we know each other, and we've just been following each other's lives and professional work since 2015. So with that, I'm going to pass you over to Robert, who's coming to us live from Iqaluit. If you've never seen that on a map, that's where that is. And he has been studying issues of indigenous rights and Inuit sovereignty the last few years as a legal scholar. So with that, we'll have Robert take the stage.
Hey, sweet. So
it's kind of
fun. This is going to be really fun because I have absolutely no idea what slide is being shown. But it is kind of far. So if we go to the next slide, we move on to something that's called Inuit Nunat. So that is, I should start with the basic introduction. Inuit, in my dialect, and I'm sure across all dialects, means the general personification. So it just means the people. Inuk is singular. You'll often hear us Inuit say Inuks, which is linguistically incorrect, but Inuit, Inuks. And then Nunat is just the land. So like the Inuit homeland is the general term used for the international scale. And if we go to the next slide, there's a more polar oriented depiction of Inuit Nunat, and you get to see all of the several different regions, how they call themselves, actually. So there's Kalahit, Nunatsiavut, Nunavik, Nunavut, Inuvialuit, Inupiaq, Yupik, and Siberian Yupik. So as you can see, we cover a vast portion of the coastline across the Arctic, and have been active players within these lands. And that's really something that I want to be able to highlight today is that when it comes to the changes that have happened to the Arctic and the changes that continue to happen due to the growing human aspect, as well as the impacts of climate change and globalization. So this is, just keep this map in mind. We'll be firing through some different regions. I myself, as mentioned, I'm from Nunavut. So somewhere in the middle of that little archipelago. And then, yeah, we'll move on. So I want to be able to start with some stories and adding a personal touch to things. So if we move to the next slide, it's adding some personality. And on the right-hand side, we can see some gentlemen out on the water in their kayak and their umiak. So this is how Inuit were able to travel very far distances across the Arctic. as well as dog sledding. And we'll get into the importance of dog sledding in a little bit. But just to start off with a story, there's this fellow called Inuluapik, and he existed in the middle of the 19th century, right around when there was an influx of attention given to the Arctic, kind of how there is now. And he paddled over from Cumberland Sound to Frobisher Bay, which is about 200 kilometers, let's say 220 kilometers, because that's an easy conversion for the American folks. But he paddled over and he just figured, you know what, I'm going to go see these whalers. I'm going to see what they need and see if I can make some money and see if, you know, I can get some wood to build another kayak, probably. That's what I would have thought. And he made his way to, if we make our way to the next slide, he made his way to Europe, all the way to Aberdeen on a whaling ship. And he learned really good English and was able to acquire a reputation amongst whalers. And that same summer that he went back, he took 30 whaling ships with him back to the original point there, Punnuktu or Pangertung. So you can see on the bottom curvature on that journey, he comes back with 30 whalers approximately and rediscovers what is now called Cumberland Sound. It hadn't been on European maps for over 200 years approximately, even though, you know, it was probably because it was choked up in ice most of the time. But this became a hotspot for whalers alongside other spots this drastically changed the whaling industry, and they started to actually overwinter in Southern Baffin instead of staying for the summer. And this changed relationships between Halunak, which is our word for a white settler or white traveler. And they would come and we would be able to engage in trade and work and relations. And so this man was really important because he was able to change the dynamic of an entire place just with the forethought of saying, hey, I'm going to go make use of what I have in front of me. And I think that planning is really important because he was able to change a lot of lives, and rightly so. And the he's the only Inuk credited with a being the, I don't know what we call that, cartographer in the Royal Admiralty chart, which is pretty cool if you ask me. So all of this because he wanted to be able to cooperate and he wanted to be able to work with people. So if we move on to the next slide, centering advocacy and cooperation, there's a lovely quote here by Mary Simon. Mary is somebody that I hold very near and dear to my heart. She is somebody who has worked as an advocate on the international scale for the well past the 40 years almost now. And she says, as Inuit, we have a responsibility to our people and our communities to secure greater international recognition of Inuit rights. At the same time, Inuit from all circumpolar countries must contribute to the integrity of the world environment and world peace by advocating coherent policies and initiatives and the establishment of an international forum where all of these concerns can be discussed and acted upon. This was in 1987 when she was a fairly young woman and at that time had been advocating for almost 10 years. And she helped create something that is called the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is the next slide, which is now called the Inuit Circumpolar Council. So this is the international level of representation for all Inuit in Inuit Nunat and even urban Inuit. I know in Canada they're somewhat represented at this. So there's four different regions, as we said, and this is something that I really liked. Is I was at one of the meetings in Ottawa, and one of the elders spoke up and said, you know, we came off the land, we came into boardrooms, and these boardrooms are still occupied by Inuit, and they're still advocating for better governance and self-determination with all these different matters. So what I hope to do next, just kind of a roadmap for the next few slides, is go through some case studies and some examples of how ICC has demonstrated their prowess at being advocates on the international scale. I may be a little bit biased, I'm sorry. But then we're also going to bring it back to a more local level on the Canadian side. So if we go to the next slide, it's the Inuit Declaration on Arctic Sovereignty. So this is a declaration that was written out by ICC, and it was actually a response to the Ilulissat Declaration, which was a form of governance at the Arctic Council, where the Arctic states came together and said, this is, you know, what we're going to do in the Arctic and how we're going to plan out the governance of the Arctic. And they did this in Ilulissat, which is in Greenland, and they didn't invite Indigenous peoples to sign it. So it was a huge slap in the face, because Indigenous peoples are permanent participants on the Arctic Council. And the Arctic Council is comprised of Arctic states, permanent participants, which are all Indigenous, and also the observers, which are folks like China, folks like France, and some other people that want a stake in the claim of the Arctic and want to establish their priorities. So what this declaration in reality tried to do is position Inuit in a way where it's like, okay, you know what, you guys are trying to plan things without us, but while you're doing that, we're also making our own plan. We're also establishing things that we want to do. We're looking at the current state of affairs, the social economic aspects. We're looking at the harvesting aspects, which is a huge aspect of Inuit society, and I'll get to an example in a bit on how important harvesting really is. So the Inuit Circumpolar Council comes up with other publications and other documents. They have a presence at the United Nations Forum for Climate Change. So that is actually how I got my foot in the door, and I met these gentlemen here, Isao and CJ. So this comes from a long time. This ICC was established in the 80s, and it's a long history, and it's really cool to just bask in that ability to, because if we go to the next slide, I'm going to get into why this is amazing, because it's not even 10 years after most Inuit have been forced into communities. So there's still Inuit living out on the land in a very traditional life, as we're on the international scale with the UN and as we're advocating for ourselves. So on all different levels here, Inuit have been practicing self-determination. So with colonial control, there came a lot of different ways the Canadian government tried to force Inuit into communities. Before that, Inuit were what is known as semi-nomadic. We followed a few different things, mostly the change of seasons. And the change of seasons, we also followed with that came the change of the animal migration routes and the availability of certain animals, you know, certain times of the year, it's better to catch fish and stock up on fish. And caribou, you want to make sure you get the pelt at the right time of the year, because then that way they won't smell so much. These little things dictated our ability to, our mobility on the land. And with the increase of interest by the federal government in the 1950s, and 60s, you saw an increase of paternalism, and you saw an increase of what, how the government interacted with Indigenous peoples at the time. I know some stories are familiar in the United States, but in Canada, there was the family child tax that was introduced. And the more you had kids, the more you were allowed to benefit off this tax. And it took the form of credit at the local trading post. And once the government saw that the Inuit were becoming dependent on this tax for things like ammunition, things like flour, like the most basic tobacco, tea, things that had become, you know, staples of Inuit life for almost 100 years. And they said, well, if you don't send your kids to residential schools, then you're not going to get your child tax. Or if you don't move into the community, if you don't move into the permanent settlement, you're not going to get your child tax. They also did this by slaughtering dogs. So There's a great documentary out, and it highlights the work of the Hikitani Truth Commission. And the Hikitani Truth Commission looked into the shared history of Inuit within my region, so the Baffin Island region, and how they were forced into settlements. But it was all sparked because Inuit wanted answers for why their dog was slaughtered by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and other government officials. And it's a very nuanced discussion, and it's a frank look at how our communities have become the way they are, and how they have dealt with this increase of a paternalistic government who had, you know, before that virtually not really cared about us. So it created this thing called Ilira. And Ilira can be explained as a powerful social fear or inhibition caused by inequality in power. So just to give an example, like my grandfather is Halunak, so my grandfather is white. And some of my mom's cousins are still scared of him because he's a white man, because of they think that he has the power, because to them, white people represent the government. So it's really a toxic environment to be dealing with. But at the same time, we're negotiating land claims. At the same time, we're able to negotiate on the international scale for the decrease in PCBs and other persistent organic pollutants. So if we move on to the next slide, I just practicing our right to self-determination. It really is all about that, is practicing. It's one thing to say, oh, we need self-determination. Nobody's going to give it to us. And in turn, people are actually going to try to take it right away from you. And that's grappling with the reality of where we are. So now we look at the land claims. We look at how these have affected our ability to practice our right to self-determination in terms of making sure that our rights are protected. So in Canada, all of these land claims are constitutionally protected. So that means they supersede any provincial law, and they supersede, well, they're pretty equal to federal law. So we have the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, the Inuvialuit Agreement, which is probably, it's most westernmost, so the one closest to you, Isao, and the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement, and then most recently the Nunatsiavut Agreement, which is in northern Labrador. So if we just keep in mind that polar projection of the map, just these four land claims themselves cover 25% of Canada, over 25% of Canada. So it's quite a large area of land to be able to say that, hey, we're able to co-manage, and we have our rights protected to harvest. We have certain rights over education, and we have the ability to work with organizations to further our interests. So if we move on to the next slide, it's a map of Nunavut. So this is my home territory. Everything in red is considered Inuit-owned lands. So on these lands, if you want to walk on this land as an Inuk, you're fine. But if you want to go walk your dog on some of this land, you might need to actually apply for a permit to operate on Inuit-owned land. Because some of it is considered sensitive. And that, you know, is, if you look at this, it's once again mostly the coastline. So just that proximity to water is important for our harvesting lifestyle. And if we think back to Inuluapik, the man who changed the face of South Baffin, one of the things that he had said when he was in Scotland was, why are your homes so far away from the water? And it might seem kind of like a funny question to folks who are sitting in the middle of the continental United States, but it's really integral, that ability to go to the water and that ability to have the right to do that, because there's stories of people, of RCMP officers slicing kayaks, and there's stories of people slaughtering dogs and cutting off our ability to hunt and our ability to practice our traditions. But in face of that, we're able to still strive as a people. And I think that's just incredible. Yeah, so you can kind of see Greenland on this map, but we'll just move on. So within Nunavut, the next slide, Nunavut Tumavik Incorporated. So within Nunavut, there's three different regions, and they all have district Inuit orgs. So what these are, they're kind of like a regional body within the territory. So I should mention that Nunavut itself is a territory of Canada. There's three territories in Canada, 10 provinces. The powers divided between provinces and the federal powers are different than powers divided between territorial governments and the federal government. But what is really neat about Nunavut is that it was created as a product of the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement. In 93, that was signed, the agreement, and within there, there was a clause that said the territory of Nunavut will be created. So we had it constitutionally protected that we were able to draw our own boundaries and change the face of Canada. So those three regions, the Khikitaluk, the Kivalluk, and the Khitikmiut, there's a very large difference in dialects, and you know, our sewing patterns are different. But you know, some of our dances, a lot of our dances are the same. I think some of Esau and I's dances would probably be a little similar. But at the end of the day, these three districts, their presidents of those organizations sit on the board of Nunavut Tungavik. And then Nunavut Tungavik is the organization that is charged with basically implementing the Nunavut Agreement. So implementing articles on employment, implementing articles on education, on language, on culture, but on things also like Inuit Impact Benefit Agreements. So these are agreements that are negotiated and developed by the regional organization. And they're to kind of make sure that any development that happens, whether it's a park, a marine protected area, resource development such as oil and gas or mining, that it happens on our own terms. It happens with Inuit input, and that we actually see tangible benefits such as resource royalties or the ability to say, hey, we don't want your cruise ship in this area. So following along on this thought, there's an excerpt here on the next slide from Parks Canada, that the IBA shall include any matter connected with the proposed park that would have a detrimental impact on Inuit or that could reasonably confer a benefit on Inuit, either on a Nunavut-wide, regional, or local basis, including, among other things, cooperative management, continuation of Inuit harvesting rights, and Inuit employment and economic benefits. So this is an agreement that covers, I think it's four different national parks. And within these national parks, there has to be a certain level of Inuit employment. The guides that are picked have to be Inuit. So this is one way that we help co-manage a lot of our tourism industry, as well as some of our prime hunting lands that are in these parks. Inuit have full harvesting rights in the parks, whereas if you're non-Inuk, you're not even allowed to carry a rifle. So it's quite a powerful agreement. And what the Nunavut Tumavik also does, if we move on to the next slide, is that they help manage the institutes of public governance. And we're going to get to the wildlife example now, because one example is the National Nunavut Wildlife Management Board. But then, so this management board is comprised of representatives from each of those district organizations as well. But they have elders, they have scientists, and they're in charge of making sure that things like caribou quotas, total allowable harvests, are able to meet not only community needs, but are based on the knowledge provided by both scientists and elders. So it's really cool to be able to say that the Nunavut Wildlife Management Board protects a lot of our rights in a lot of our ways, and allows Inuits to be agents within a system that has been historically used by the federal government in a way to try to control our lives, harvesting rights, I should say. A few bullet points here on why what the NWMB does, the Nunavut Wildlife Management Board. We do deal with a lot of acronyms. I am apologizing for that. It's pretty bad. But so they had their AGM in Iqaluit, and they deal with people like the Department of Environment, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Environment Canada, Parks Canada, Arctic Fishery Alliance, and then a lot of guides as well. So hunting guides, they all come together, and the AGM is pretty formal thing because they have regular meetings throughout the year. And but this is where all the public sharing of information happens. And here's a really cool example, I think, is the Inuit Bowhead Whale Knowledge Study. So this is what was triggered when Inuit decided we are going to harvest whales again. So as the whaling industry diminished at the turn of the 20th century, Inuit were stripped of their ability to participate in that industry. And it was an economic blow, but it was also was a perpetuation of a culture of harvesting whales that comes from thousands of years. So fortunately, there was enough elders in this one place called Iqaluit, which is, if you look on the right-hand side of the slide, there's the community groupings, so different geographic regions wherein they would harvest the bowhead. So you have the Hudson Strait, the Hudson Bay, and then the middle is Fox Basin, and that's where Iqaluit sits. And in the 70s, there was an elder, 1970s, if we fast forward, there was an elder there that was not doing very well. And he said, I want to taste whale meat one more time before I die. But at this point, Inuit had been told that they weren't allowed to harvest whales. And they were told, you know what, it's not proper, it's inhumane. Greenpeace was on us at this point for sealskin. They had destroyed our economic market for sealskin. So that's why I'm proud to wear my sealskin tie here tonight. and the elder just said, you know what, I just want to do it. And that elder had a considerable amount of clout within the community, and they went and harvested a whale. If that's not practicing self-determination, then I really, really don't know what it is. And from there, the negotiations for the Nunavut Agreement, I should say, so the basis of all this right had begun to be negotiated at this point. So as we're moving into the boardrooms, we're still out there hunting. And from this, the federal government and other actors saw that we were able to properly manage a whale hunt and be able to do it in a culturally sound way that wasn't wasteful, and that wasn't all the things that, you know, Southern society would probably look down upon. So the Bowhead Whale Knowledge Study was another thing that was triggered out of this original harvesting of the whale. When the Nunavut Wildlife Management Board was created, they decided, well, we need a solid base of knowledge to manage properly. And so a total allowable harvest is established. So this year, my community of Iqaluit was actually able to harvest a bowhead. So just wanted to finish it off on this really cool example, because a couple of my aunts were actually harpooners for this bowhead whale. So if you are not keen on seeing a whale being harvested, I would close my eyes. But if you go to the next slide, there's my aunt with her harpoon and that whale that was harvested. So this whale was then taken to the community and distributed between the hunters and the elders. And we were able to harvest everything, like every single last piece of baleen. We harvested some bones for our hayap. And this is just the perpetuation of planning. This to me is what signifies, you know, you want to see the juxtaposition of planning and self-determination and the ability to manage our own affairs. Like, I just I think this is it. And I'm just really happy to be here to share that story with you. And the muttuk, so the whale blubber and the whale skin, I was able to have some of this whale. And I was unfortunately out of town, so I couldn't participate. But I heard so many great stories from my aunties. And it's just a story that I love to share because I think it highlights where we are as Inuit. We've had some power taken away from us, but now we're here. We're continuing to harvest. We're continuing to educate people. And we're having a lot of fun doing it. At least I do. And I just wanted to thank you guys for your attention. And I'm looking forward to hearing these fellas speak as well.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's always so awesome to hear Robert fuse both law and storytelling with family stories. It makes law so much more interesting. So I'd like to offer a little bit of a high-level perspective from somebody trained in urban and regional planning. So as I mentioned, I come from the lower latitudes, and when it came to Arctic issues, there's a lot of education that had to be had and is continuing. But one thing I'd like to discuss today is really how our shared climate system impacts Arctic human well-being as well as Inuit sovereignty. And so I'm going to outline a bit of what's happening on the ground when it comes to community planning as well as adaptation planning. And also something that some of you may have heard of before called loss and damage. So these are some of the conditions that are beyond our ability as humans and communities to adapt to. So as we know, it's getting hot in here. Our ocean and our land temperatures are on the rise. 2017, 2018 were the hottest 2 years consecutively. And one thing that's important to know is that all of this has a major impact in the high latitudes. This is the last 1979 to 2018 Arctic sea extent. So we can watch this red line, which is that millions of kilometers squared in annual ice. So during the winter, it grows, and during the summer, and it shrinks. In September, it kind of hits its low. And so what we're watching is really our cryosphere in the northern hemisphere on the ocean being reduced. And so the thing about the way that our planet works is that things, including pollution and heat, go to the poles. And so whatever we have warming in the lower latitudes is amplified up in those high latitudes where the ice is. The ice provides a lot of things for us. It is not just the homelands of the Inuit, and it provides hunting and a full food system, but it also controls our climate. So when we look at the heat of summers and the cold of winters, being able to have something in the northern hemisphere that reflects heat back out into the space, because it's white, is massive. And also it helps cool our global climate system. So that is really at the heart of how we're connected to the Arctic. Not only does it threaten 25,000 Nanook, polar bears, 2.9 million reindeer, 1.5 million seals, but the 4 million Arctic human beings. And something in Inuit is called Sila, which is this really in-depth and really beautiful relationship with our natural world. And so when we look at the way that the climate is changing, when we think about, ooh, it's impacting those polar bears, we need to remember that it's impacting the human beings who have had a relationship with them for a long time. And so I'd like to share with you a piece that I collaborated with the Alaska Nanook Commission and Polar Bears International on a few years ago, and it is about really the inherent resilience of Inuit people, as well as the inherent stewardship and conservation values they have when it comes to subsistence hunting of polar bears.
You hear that Native people are the sentinels of the Arctic, and that's true. We've been hearing about climate change for almost a decade now. We've been hearing reports from local hunters for the last 20 to 30 years about changing sea ice conditions, extent and duration. As sentinels, they are responsive immediately to changes or fluctuations in their environment and changing climatological patterns as well. One of the first pieces of direction our founder, my mentor, Charlie Johnson, gave me was to go to Barrow to meet our chairman, Charlie Brower. His instruction for me was to eat a pot of his polar bear soup. It was my first experience with polar bears. They wanted me to come up there eat polar bear, interact with polar bear, so that I would be a more effective advocate for our continued ability to harvest polar bears to feed ourselves. Polar bears just aren't iconic species of the Arctic. They aren't something to be revered in a zoo, photographs, postcards, but they are intricate living parts of people's histories, cultures, and environment.
We have dances about them, we have stories about them.
As Native people, we had sort of inherent conservation values. If we overharvested, we wouldn't have the ability to feed ourselves the next season. Polar bears have now become the global iconic species of the Arctic.
We told scientists that our ice was thinner, but they didn't believe us until the scientists studied the ice conditions up here, and now everybody knows that our ice is thinner and our climate is getting warmer.
The primary threat facing polar bears today is habitat loss due to global climate change.
While it brings a global focus and a global perspective on sort of the plight of the polar bear, there are these unfair demands on indigenous people who still continue to use polar bears as food.
PBI does support a well-managed subsistence harvest for sure.
Polar bears are still at levels in many areas of the world that can still support harvest, so long as that harvest benefits the local community. Unlike climate change, which takes decades to revert the impact of, harvest is something we can manage in real time.
People who live and utilize the resources should have a significant part of how these resources are managed. And our founder said that the U.S. federal government was going to have a formal role in polar bear management. Native people should have a role in that as well. 15 villages passed resolutions under this authority of co-management. So we represent 15 communities from Kaktovik to St. Lawrence Island in the management of the two U.S. polar bear populations.
We recognize the reality that if we're talking about conserving a species, we have to work with the people who live with that species. If we want a resilient population of polar bears, we need resilient communities that are going to live in health and harmony with those bears. So I see Western science and indigenous knowledge as being very complementary systems. With indigenous knowledge, you have a very deep and historical set of knowledge about a place and wildlife that uses that place and the physical attributes of the place. In this case of the Arctic, we're thinking of things like sea ice, snow, that are really important. Science can complement that local knowledge in a shorter time scale. It can also take us much broader spatially, so we can get a slightly larger view and go beyond where people actually use the land. Adding those two layers together, to me, is much more useful and informative than trying to keep them apart.
If we want bears for our next generation, we got to start thinking about trying to save them. And I think it's really important to save their environment.
Rather than having these ideas about how to manage local resources come from agencies or individuals who have never even set foot in the Arctic, we know that doesn't work. Taking the approach of polar bear management, that each local village should be taking the initiative and developing what works for them in that local village.
The people who live here know about our climate, know about living in these conditions, and we share these conditions with the polar bear.
It's very easy to sit from afar and cast stones at indigenous lifestyles. The perspective that most policymakers don't have is the direct impacts that those decisions and policy has on the indigenous people.
So we still rely a lot on the native food, and we're trying to keep it so our next generation, like my grandchildren, continue to harvest that food.
The only place I want to be is out there on the ocean, on the ice, with my uncles, with my cousins, with everyone in the village,
hunt for sea mammals and fill up our freezers.
So that was an incredible film to make. And as somebody who had never really thought about it, there was a lot more that, of course, was in the picture. When we think about conserving a species, having the original stewards of that species, their relative, at the table and making decisions is absolutely the way forward. And so that just became really clear. So we have thinning sea ice. We have bears in town for longer, which is leads to human-bear conflict. These things are happening, but what's happening in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. So there's this idea that damage against one is damage towards all when it comes to indigenous rights and harvest. Secondly, sea level rise. Where does that ice go from the ice caps, the sea ice, the glacial ice, that goes into the ocean. And a massive amount of our global population lives within 50 kilometers of the coast. And so when we think about the future of the Arctic, when that water leaves the Arctic, it is estimated that 2 billion people will be displaced by 2100. Those global temperature flows, as we saw within that NASA visualization, are impacted by that Arctic sea ice, that big, cold, white mass at the top of the Earth. And as the Arctic warms, the release of methane is an accelerant to the already warming climate system. So it's not just Arctic communities. So one of the big things is like, okay, what are we doing about it? You know, we don't have a progressive federal leadership on climate policy right now, but to be understated. But the rest of the world's moving forward. And I think it's important to realize that all of us have to be acting to keep the Arctic around politically in our businesses, et cetera. And so one of the most important things that we've seen in the global climate policy, I've been working at the United Nations level for the last 5 years, and so far the most important thing that I think is important is we've been getting some things done. It's not just talk. One of the most notable things was in 1987, the Montreal Protocol. Does anyone remember that name? Okay, a couple heads nodding. Most of us weren't born yet, but it's okay. But that's important because it allowed us to phase out things that deplete the ozone, and we could place a sanction on countries who didn't live up to their promises. COP21, where I was able to meet these two gentlemen, that was really a holistic agreement. We were able to bring in targets to limit the general warming, 1.5 Celsius from today's, from post industrial revolution. And that's really important in the Arctic because we know everything's amplified. Indigenous rights are in the preamble of that agreement. And then we also created a section that I was involved in as a researcher, Article 8 on loss and damage. And this deals with the really existential, challenging stuff, the loss of species, the loss of language, et cetera, relocation of countries and communities. And something that we just wrapped up was in Poland. This is the 24th Conference of Parties at the UN, FCCC. And we completed the rule book to implement the Paris Agreement. And as part of that, we created and endowed the Indigenous People and Local Communities platform with $1 million and a focal point. So next time someone says nothing happens at the UN, the answer is we sometimes get some things done when it comes to climate. So we hear things getting thrown around today. Oh, you know, we got greenhouse gases, blah, blah, blah. But I think I want you to walk away with these three main concepts. And the biggest one that we really have to concern ourselves with in the lower latitudes is mitigation. That's reducing the tons of carbon that enter the atmosphere. Why is that important? The more carbon, the more warming. And when it happens, when we do emit that carbon, it increases our need to adapt. And adaptation is very expensive. This is the green and gray alterations of ecological, social, and economic systems to a changing climate. And what we cannot adapt to is loss and damage. These are our lost coastlines, communities, species, et cetera. But again, stronger mitigation, it secures a future for the Arctic. Adaptation is really what we think about as the process of being accustomed to change. This is from an Inuit perspective, and I've thought it to be very invoking and very inspiring when we think about adaptation as something that is inherent to an Inuit way of being. But when it comes to communities all around the world, adaptation is something we're already facing. Bigger forest fires, hotter summers, higher waters, and loss and damage. And this is what we're going to dive into in addition to adaptation from the work that I've been involved with the last few years. So because a lot of us come from the Arctic state of the United States, Canada, the United States are Arctic members of the Arctic Council, are federal states of that. And so I want us to just look north to our neighbors and our Inuit brothers and sisters in Alaska. And the reality is, as in many other places with climate adaptation, Native communities are leading the way. Here in Montana, the CSKT, Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribes, have finished their adaptation plan 5 years ago. And when we look to the northern communities of the Northwest Borough, as well as the Seward Peninsula, we see not just early sort of thinking about adaptation, so you can see in yellow here impact assessment trainings, but we also are seeing clusters of climate adaptation plans being done and being implemented. So the reality is this isn't something that's happening in a foreign land like Bangladesh. This is happening to our fellow U.S. citizens in Alaska. So when we think about adaptation, these are some of the measures that I'm talking about. And globally, there are some things that the Arctic shares when we look at sea level rise, storm surge, flood risk, glacial retreat. But the reality is there's some really unique things that northern people are having to adapt to. One of the most visceral things is erosion. So when we have low sea ice years and we get those big Arctic storms, storm surge and erosion is eating away the shore of some of these northern communities up to 61 feet a year. So we can see in red up high left, this is the North Slope. And of course, always on the charge, Native communities of Alaska are writing their plans to address that. And this is Nutok Village. It won an award for their climate adaptation plan called Ultimate Adaptation Plan -evacuation, which is something they have to deal with. This is the middle of town down here on the left during high tide in a storm. And so these are ways in which northern communities are already addressing some of these challenges. Loss and damage, something I want us to just think about and to know as a concept walking away from tonight. These are the things that are beyond our ability to adapt to climate change. And it's climate change interacting with social vulnerability. And one of these things that we think about is there are short term. These are bigger storms. These are bigger floods. These are the fast onset. And then on the long term, we have things that are slow climatic change in those medians. Those are the things that we're going to have to deal with, which are submerged nations, relocated communities, lost species. But back to mitigation, the more ambitious we are with mitigation, the less of this loss and damage that we're going to have to deal with. So when we think about exposure and vulnerability interacting, that's really what's at the heart of what's happening in northern communities. And in an adaptation planning sphere, what's happening at the village and at the state level is that they're having to create action plans that address the physical risk, but then also the drivers of sensitivity, like social vulnerability. So social vulnerability is a concept that's been around for a few decades now. It's studied at the county level. You can find it online for Gallatin County or wherever we're all coming from. It's these demographic and social economic factors that make people really sensitive and exposed to it. So things like poverty, the age of your housing, as far as flood control, like how high are you sleeping above the floodplain? These are all things we gather in the census and other government data sources that we combine to say, how vulnerable are we? And when we look at Alaska, we can see this western slope and all of these northern areas with higher social vulnerability are predominantly indigenous regions. So when we have the risk over here is permafrost thaw on the roadways and on the places, it interacts in the highly intensified areas with these Native communities. So when we look at this, we have those unique risks. You know, it's everything from rising temperatures, higher storm surge, habitat loss, et cetera. We know the problem. We've studied it really well. Right now, it's really in the hands of putting resources to finish the planning and to give the resources to implement those plans for northern communities. And so I just want to, just reiterate that when it comes to the future of the Arctic, it's the Arctic, indigenous governments that are going to be at the driver's seat. But there are fellow citizens. So right here, this is about a dozen villages that are considered relocating, and we'll be discussing the decision to move with Esau's talk. He comes from the village of Shishmaref, which is up here in the Seward Peninsula up north, just south of Kivalina. Has anyone been up to this part of Alaska? Okay, a few hands. Awesome. And so this is a really challenging decision, and Esau will give us some insight on that, but Shishmaref as a village and their council decided to move by a narrow vote. They're going to move their village, and it'll be very expensive, and it has to be very thoughtful to be done right. So when we think about how do we, you know, address some of these things up in the Arctic, first and foremost, from a planning perspective and a legal perspective, our best outcomes are going to come when we privilege indigenous sovereignty, knowledge, and resilience. Like we saw in the video, we can combine these traditional knowledge sets and Western science to create really comprehensive analysis. No consent equals no planning. We're not going to do anything unless there's consent of those local governments, those local tribal governments. And the reality is there's a ton of knowledge in the land, and there's a ton of knowledge holders who can just help us make better plans when it comes to the future of Arctic communities. Our risk assessments are front and center there. Fast onset, those are early warning systems, things that we can say, hey, there's going to be a big storm surge. Everyone gets a text on their phone. We can learn from other parts of the world to do this really well. And slow onset, and that's something that Esau will talk about, which is the relocations, the loss of habitat. And one thing is that they are our fellow citizens. And one of the big ways that we get through big disaster events like Katrina or Harvey is risk pooling. Insurance is one of those things, but it allows us to share the weight. And the reality is that Arctic communities have contributed very little when it comes to anthropogenic climate change. So there's some federal accountability and sharing risk. And the last is addressing cultural and non-monetary loss and damage. This is the stuff that will arguably is a continuation of the trauma of imperialism, and it has the ability to really ruin lives and cultures. And so making space for unified healing as well as some of the psychological support that comes with losing a village, losing your house, losing your hunting grounds. So this stuff gets really dark fast, but the reality is we still have time. We just have to act now. And so there's been a lot of talk about how we move forward. And we know that TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, northern knowledge, local ecological knowledge, isn't being integrated very well into the planning processes of the state and the federal government. And so when we look at the future, like, oh, how do we make the best policies? You know, we have to talk to the knowledge holders and privilege them, not just in a tokenistic way, but in a way that gives them the power to create really good plans and policies. This came from a fall scientific paper, and it really just points towards scientists, experts, policymakers having this closer cooperation channel with local Native communities. Those include those collaborative networks, just getting people connected, including observer networks, what's happening on the ground, so citizen science, and then projects based on traditional Arctic knowledge. Something that Latrice noted is that it's really important that we support our indigenous scholars and we support our policymakers, because how can we really work that into a system if we don't have the people who are most impacted and have them prepared to be part of that? And really just it leads to better outcomes, better strategies and policies. So I wanna support Robert and bringing up this Circumpolar Inuit Declaration of Sovereignty. It's very, very well composed, and it gives great guidance, specifically section 3 and 3.6 right here on the right column outlines exactly how Inuit should be involved. And everything from the conservation of species like polar bears to the creation of adaptive management plans, any plan or policy concerning the lives of indigenous people of the Arctic, community regional development plans, relocation, infrastructure, including roads, highways, railways, anything that connects life up north, as well as there's been a lot of hype around these 5 proposed shipping routes through the Arctic. And as Robert noted, most of those come right through their homeland and they have the sovereignty to say no. And that's at the heart of this, is the ability to say no or the ability to say, here's how we'd like it done. So I wanted to share some stories. For the last, as I mentioned, I've been working at the UN Climate Talks for 5 years. In the last 2 years, I decided that while it's fascinating to sit in rooms for 12 to 16 hours a day and study legal language, the people are incredible. And so as you can see, this is these are some early results. My goal with this was to really remind us and to celebrate good leadership, the power of good leadership. And whether you're from Sami or, you know, Nunavut or you're from southern latitudes like us, there are people working together every day to shape a responsible future for the Arctic. And so the goal was to create a platform to capture a portrait and a short interview. And I feel like one of the luckiest people at these conferences because I get to shoot the breeze and make a portrait and an interview with these leaders for 15 minutes. And so you can see up in the right-hand corner, this is the mobile lighting and film studio. It fits in these three very heavy bags. And so for up to 2 weeks, I'm at the climate talks and communicating with leaders about when they're available to meet, what are they up to, what are they passionate about, why do they continue to show up. And so this hasn't been released yet. This will be a story project that will be online in the coming year. And this is what it looks like. It's basically shooting in the halls of the United Nations negotiations using mobile wireless lighting, and I make one portrait and then an interview. And so here's some of the early examples, and I can let you read some of these, but just incredible stories of leadership. So I'll just introduce them and you can read. This is Jani Staffensen. She's trained as a lawyer, and she is on the Sami Council of Sweden, and she is one of the focal points for the Indigenous Peoples Caucus and forum at the UN. Riley Yesno, she's on the National Minister's Youth Council for the Prime Minister of Canada, and she comes from a northern, almost northern community in Anishinaabe, and grew up on the land with her parents. And our final one, Christiana Figueres, really important in creating and shepherding the Paris Agreement to be finished in 2015. So from these voices, I realized something. Women in politics is a really good thing. And the power of young Indigenous voices and the clarity and the groundedness. There's a lot of theory behind that for the reason why it's so clear, but I think the reality is being able to make space and to have those folks at the decision-making table is our only way moving forward. So I want to leave you with that in mind. And I also, you're going to have a chance to meet Esau in a moment. And as we think about our relations, just consider what is our responsibility to Arctic people? As fellow citizens, you know, whether you're living in southern Canada or you're living in the lower latitude 48 states of the United States, what's our responsibility to our Arctic citizens, our friends, and what do we want to do about that? So with that, I'm going to pass you off to Esau Sunnuk from the community of Shishmaref, Alaska. And Esau, I can run your slides.
All right. Thank you, CJ. So like I said earlier, my name is Esau Sunnuk. That's my English name. My Inupiaq name is, I have two of them, Kugagluiluk, named after my grandfather, Esau Wewana, and Telik, which is named after Ralph Olana from Nome. And just to give a little brief history of Alaska, we can go to that Alaska map, Alaska culture map. I know. So Shishmaref is north of Nome. It's 123 miles north of Nome. I am Inupiaq, which is part of the, how do you say, categorization of Inuit. And that's the northwest to northern part of Alaska. We also have Central Yupik, which is the southwest Alaska. And then we have Siberian Yupik on St. Lawrence Island, which is Savunga and Gamble. The two Siberian Yupik communities on St. Lawrence Island. And then we have our brothers and sisters from Russia. And just to go off a little bit on Robert's talk earlier with land claims. So each region in Alaska, we have corporations. So back in 1972 or 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlements Act was passed, and it divided Alaska into different regions of corporations so what we have here in Alaska is a permanent fund dividend, and that is thanks to the use of our lands for the extraction of oil from Prudhoe Bay up in northern Alaska all the way down to Valdez. And during that time, you know, there was no talks of land claims. And that was when the Alaska Federation of Natives was created back in 1968. So within that time, little short time frame, they were able to come up with this Land Claims Act that essentially divided our lands and our regions here in Alaska into corporations. So Shishmaref is part of Bering Strait Native Corporation. We do have one reservation in Alaska, which is Metlakatla, which is they govern their own community, their own hunting and fishing, and everything that is included in that. And I think that's pretty cool. But we do have to work with, you know, the United States government on subsistence, on our hunting and fishing. And, you know, it could be tough sometimes, you know, working with Fish and Wildlife Service, with State of Alaska, and all these different entities that come into when, where, how much we can gather our animals that we need to survive. So that's a little brief history of Alaska. I could talk more, but to move on. So I'm from Shishmaref, Alaska, which CJ talked earlier, is one of the 12 communities in Alaska that is being affected by climate change. And we are now having to relocate because of climate change, you know. So Shishmaref is a 3 mile long, a quarter mile wide island. And before we were settled onto the island, we used to live with our families and be semi-nomadic. Also, like Robert said earlier, you know, we just followed the animals during seasons. We used to live up the coast, down the coast, and on the mainland. And back in early 1900s, we were forced to live on this island, which is now called Shishmaref, because of the Western education system, the school, and the Lutheran Church. So that's my history of my people. And now Shishmaref, as I said earlier, is one of the 12 villages in Alaska being looking into the exploration of relocation because of climate change. So we can move to the next slide. This is just a couple of picture examples of what we do experience in Shishmaref. You know, every single fall time we have storm surges and flooding, which means a lot of our land is lost because of climate change, because of rising sea levels, because of the lack of ice, you know, because the ice acts as a buffer for our island before the storm comes in. And, you know, recently in the past few years, we've been experiencing a pretty late freezing of our sea ice and our lagoon ice. And that causes a lot of trouble for our community, for the island, but also a psychological standpoint. It also, you know, it affects us too, because we had times during the year where we go out on the ice to go hunt and to ice fish. And without that, you know, it really could really be really bad for some people, because we're just so used to it. And, you know, not being able to do what we love, what we keep doing is our culture, you know, it's really has a effect on our mental state, on our mental state of mind. And, you know, back in 2016, so we were feeling the effects of climate change ever since, you know, the 40s and the 50s, 1940s, 1950s. I remember my grandfather told me, you know, when he was a little kid, a boy, that the ice used to freeze in late September and October, and the ice used to be, as he would say, as thick as the inside of the house, or even thicker, which is about 8 to 10 feet thick. And now, you know, 70 years later, just these last recent years, our sea ice and our lagoon ice haven't been freezing until middle of December. And I remember just a couple of years ago, I went back home for Christmas break. I'm a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and going home in December and then not seeing the ice not freeze until a couple weeks later when I went back to school in Fairbanks, which was end of January, seeing that and hearing about that, you know, it's really what we're experiencing in the Arctic, you know, here in Alaska and all over Alaska is feeling the effects of climate change. You know, it's not just Shishmaref, it's communities like Newtok and Kivalina, Nome, Unalakleet, Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow. And even in the cities, the Fairbanks and Anchorage, you know, they're feeling the effects of climate change too. So it's all up to us as people, as to protect our lands, to protect our environment, to do as much as we can to reduce the effects of climate change, because it just doesn't affect, you know, as you probably see in the news, Nanooks, which is polar bears, or the ice, you know, it affects us too, the people that live in the Arctic. So, and all across the Arctic too, it's not just Alaska, you know, it's Canada, it's Greenland, it's Russia, it's these states in the Arctic that is feeling the effects, and the people living there are feeling the effects of climate change. You know, the Arctic is warming twice as fast than any other place in the world. And Janie, I think she talked about it too, you know, the 3 degrees, the 1 degree, 2 degrees, whatever the documents wants to say, limits of CO2, you know, it's twice as much here in the Arctic. So with that, it really does mean a matter of time of when we will relocate the community and how, because it costs, as estimated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, $180 million back in 2004 to relocate the entire community of Shishmaref, which is 600 people. And 15 years later, you know, that has probably risen. And ever since then, you know, there's a lot of things that happened in between. And now back in 2016, 3 years ago, we voted to relocate, which was the third time that the community voted to relocate. First was in 1973, and the second was in 2001, I believe. And, you know, it's just a matter of time of when and how we're going to relocate. And I think I wanted to talk about everything I wanted to talk about.
So we have some time for questions, and what might work is, because they're getting my feed in from this, if you want to relay me a question, if you want to tell me a question, I can relay it to our two folks joining us from the Arctic. But this question is for you, Isa. Has a new location been selected for the location of Shishmaref?
Yeah, back in 2016, when we did vote to relocate, we voted to relocate to Old West Pond, I believe. That's where we're being relocated, and that's about 10 miles away from Shishmaref, the island, onto the mainland. And right now we're in the process of all the paperwork, all the terminology, all the legal stuff behind relocation.
Isa, did you hear that question, or Robert, as far as subsistence and ceremonial use of Nanook? It's the story of why Nanook is used for ceremonial and subsistence when there's other animals within the food web.
I guess it just comes from the special relationship that Inuit share with Nanuk and all of our relations and all of our different ways of harvesting them and using them in ways that have been sustainable. So polar bear harvests in Canada are highly sustainable. It's a practice that's been done for thousands of years. So I can only really speak to the Canadian aspect where we still do it to maintain that part of our livelihoods. There's elders in our communities that, you know, absolutely adore the meat and the certain different parts of polar bear. And, you know, polar bear stew is pretty damn good. So it's in the ceremonial aspect is kind of just a way of ensuring that the harvest that we do with these animals and is done in a very respectful way and in a very sustainable way.
Yeah, to go off, Robert, you know, here in Alaska, so my, how do I want to say that, answer that question? Some people do hunt polar bears here in Alaska, but it's not our primary source of our food. You know, our primary source for shishmaref is walrus, seals, and on the mainland we have caribou, moose, muskox, ducks, geese, ptarmigan, you know, these animals. And in different parts of Alaska, you know, in Inupiaq region, we have dances named after some animals. And, you know, we have Nalikituk, which is the feast, thanks to the whale for giving themselves to us. You know, as Inupiaq people, we believe that the animals, they give themselves to us, that we, that it's not just us going to them. And in some communities, we don't even use the word hunt. Some of us say, you know, I'm just going out on the land, or I'm going to go look out on the land or on the water. And, you know, it's a very, it's a relationship between the animals and us, because without the animals, we wouldn't be here. And thanks to them, we are able to sustain ourselves and to live in a community where a majority of our diet is traditional food. So
I'd like to supplement with that. When we think about some of these northern communities, country food is a main staple of healthy eating. And when you think about when a gallon of milk costs $12, or a pound of beef is, you know, $16 a pound, traditional foods and continuing subsistence harvests is important to ensure food sovereignty moving forward in the continuation of ways of being. It's complicated, and there's many different protein sources. And from when we look at the numbers for subsistence hunts that are allowed in a co-managed fashion in Canada and in Arctic Alaska, we see continual underhunting with polar bear. They could sell it. They could sell the hunt. They could use it for control in town. Like if there was a polar bear in town that was being dangerous, they could take that animal. But for the last few years, they consistently undertake. So there's a kind of a conservation value there as well. The question is for both of you two, and that is you know, we have more infrastructure by sea and by land, new roads in Northwest Canada. Is tourism something that, you know, folks in your communities would like to see? And if tourism were to happen, what would it look like?
Do you want to go first, Robert? okay, so, you know, shishmaref is not a really... You know, you don't see the name shishmaref on, you know, on the websites of, you know, airplanes and whatever companies that, you know, advertise tourism. But in Alaska, there are routes where, you know, these big cruise ships are now going through. You know, I think the last 2016, I remember going to Nome, and then this huge cruise ship was docked at the port, and that was carrying a few thousand people, and that's as much as the community of Nome, which is about 3,000 to 35. It depends on the year, because summertime there's stuff that's going on in Nome that brings a lot of people, like jobs. But you know, in Alaska, tourism, I don't want to say, well, it's a complicated thing, because you know, our sea mammals, they use routes that they've been going through for time immemorial. And you know, just 2014, Shell tried to get a leasing in the Chukchi Sea, the Beaufort Sea here in Alaska, and that would affect our traditional hunting. I wouldn't be the one to ask about tourism in my part of Alaska, other than Nome and that cruise ship and that new route. Yeah.
So just for full disclosure, I'm very active in the cruise ship tourism industry myself. I work for an operator called Adventure Canada, and we do cruises through Inuit Nunangat, through the Inuit homeland, the Arctic. We do Northwest Passage trips and Baffin Bay trips, and I've been working. It'll be my sixth season coming up this year, finalizing all those plans for now. And it's a complicated issue. So I've had some of my family members just look at me and say, how could you be so complicit in such an extractionist industry? Not only, you know, are they coming in and taking things and then leaving right away, but they're paying a lot of money to do it. And the way that I look at it is that the industry is going to happen. There's been a tenfold increase in the number of cruise ships that are even attempting to sail through the Northwest Passage. And I think the ship that Isao is referencing would be the Crystal Serenity. They're building a polar ship. So it's an increasing industry. And as with other industries that Inuit have had an influence in, I think that we need to be in positions of authority, and we need to have that capacity to operate within the industry. And take advantage of the growth in infrastructure. You know, my community is finally getting a deep sea port, the biggest community in my territory by almost 5,000 at 8,000 people. So we're getting a deep sea port, and that'll help alleviate some of the infrastructure issues for the other communities around us. But it'll be the first Arctic port in Canada, if you don't count a non-operational mine. So the increase in infrastructure is a good thing. The economic benefits are a good thing, but we got to make sure that it's happening on our terms. So as a young law student that's in the industry, I do want to go into this area of law, and I do want to advocate on behalf of Inuit to make sure that, you know, maybe we can sign an Inuit impact benefit agreement, because I do know some of the bad things that happen when these ships come into our communities. You know, it's... We tell our passengers, don't go in and buy out the store just because you haven't had a bag of chips in a couple of weeks. Don't go in and take all the money out of the ATM. They might not be getting another load of money for another week because of the way that the infrastructure works. So it's about handling the increase in a way that's in control. And it's a lot to think about. I'm on an island, so the roads kind of doesn't apply, but the increase in marine tourism has definitely been noted.
Awesome. I will add two considerations that have been part of discussions when it comes to increasing ship traffic and tourism, one of which is an emergency response plan and rescue for ships. So we don't totally know how to handle something like an oil spill from a cruise ship or a tanker when it comes into Arctic waters. So there's that component, as well as rescuing those people. And the other component is more of a community development concern, is that how do you capture income from a cruise ship if they are providing their people with everything they need? So there's that sweet spot for a local community to capture some of that income while managing some of those impacts. So next question.
Just one more note there, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go on.
So as you're saying, how do we maximize economic benefit? Especially in Canada, where our laws pertaining to the use of marine mammal products are extremely different So in Canada, for the most part, anything that we harvest, we're allowed to use, we're allowed to wear, we're allowed to sell. But internationally, this is not the case. So we get a lot of American clients that come on and they want to buy beautiful things because guess what? Inuit make their arts and crafts out of, and all of our beautiful clothing and a lot of things around our home are made with these products that might actually even be at risk because of this increase in shipping. So it's just this tremendous influx that's needs to be handled properly. So those economic benefits, as CJ mentions, are crucial.
What are the impacts of melting permafrost on communities and ecosystems?
Well, I know in my community, we've had a few issues with public infrastructure, whether it be pipes, you know, laying down pipes in a way that you're being preventative so that they don't, you know, burst because of the permafrost thawing and then all of a sudden shifting a piece of land. There's also things like we have to build all of our buildings on steel piles piled into the ground. So we're basically living on ladders because of the permafrost and the rocks. Our local arena, our new arena, they put a slab of cement down on the ground and they were like, oh, it's going to be fine. We have an arena now. It's amazing. Beautiful rink, state of the art. Not even 4 years later, it was forced to shut down because of melting permafrost that they didn't take into account. So it's costly at that point. But permafrost, the melting permafrost is also affecting our harvesting abilities. So our ability to maintain traditional routes and traditional places in which our families have hunted forever, we're no longer being able to access. And then there's also the impact that the changing permafrost has on the animals as well. And then that impacts us. So it's always needs to be looked at in that holistic cycle where we how we relate to each other.
So the community of Shishmaref is actually built on permafrost. The island is, you know, underneath is permafrost. The pictures that was shown, you know, that was our Inituks, which is our meat rack. That's where our we go and, you know, draw our meat from the seals. And, you know, with that loss of that land, we also ferment walrus in that permafrost, which is called Ushak. And that is my favorite type of Eskimo food. So with the permafrost in Shishmaref, which is being broken up every year, every fall time, you know, it really does impact not just the island, but also our traditional way of life, where we seem to think where we will have our drying racks and where and how we're gonna, you know, ferment some foods, but living in Fairbanks for the past 3 years, you know that there's permafrost all over the city in Fairbanks. You know, there's the roads are built on permafrost, the houses, you know, some houses are built on permafrost, and you know that really affects the quality of the roads and the houses.
Sort of to pivot that question is, how do we reduce a footprint? If we're a growing population, how does each person have in each nation per capita and as a whole have a smaller footprint? So ecologically and from a carbon perspective. So did you two want to comment on that? Do we talk anything about that when we were in Paris or other forums? The question was around just global population and how it impacts the future of the Arctic.
No, I think you covered it pretty good. Just to highlight the idea that, I don't know, I don't think I mentioned this in my presentation, but there's only about 175,000 Inuit in the world. And if you remember what the map looks like earlier, that's a lot of land for a lot of little people. So when we do come to things like the United Nations Forum on Climate Change to advocate on behalf of our livelihoods, we might be small, but I think we've been pretty adamant on the fact that, you know, we want, as CJ say, we want people to be held accountable. We want people to have responsibilities and to think of, you know, the carbon that you're emitting that doesn't stay where you are, that rises up into the system and then comes back down and drops back down into the Arctic at much higher levels than it drops back down into any other part of the world. So that, yeah, just highlighting that advocacy aspect, I think, and taking that responsibility would be huge. Be huge. Part of the reason why, you know, I put myself in these situations on behalf of, you know, to add that human dimension, to say, hey, listen, it's not just ice and snow. There are people being affected by these issues.
Awesome. Bozeman, thank you so much for showing up for the Arctic, both tonight and moving forward. And when things get confusing, just think about our friends in the Arctic.